This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
Hey, everybody, I'm Francesca Maxime. Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. I am continuing to explore some of the more creative arts and things that I feel really sustain us and bring us joy during times of challenge. And the pandemic has certainly been that. And I'm here today with pianist Emmett Cohen. And he is hailing in from lovely Harlem, New York, his home, and has just come back from a trip where he was touring in Russia. And I want to talk today a little bit about practicing a spiritual practice and sort of, or how the discipline of practicing can kind of, you know, sort of work with us in ways that enable us to kind of share our best selves with the world in the way that you do. You bring joy to people. At least you brought joy to me. In my household over the winter. So welcome, Emmett. Thanks so much for joining us here on Rerooted.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So first of all, tell me, you just got back from Russia about a week ago. You were touring. What is it like to tour during the pandemic?
Well, it can be nerve-wracking for some people. But we've been lucky. I think we took our first trip in August, and we went to Vail right at the beginning of August or end of July 2020. And so we've been conditioned. So I've been on a few planes and been in and out of some different situations where, you know, I guess, you know, we're less comfortable than we used to be. But I always kind of imagine how Dizzy Gillespie or Louis Armstrong would have thought about this time and you know, I have a premonition that they would really, you know, feel like they needed to bring the music to this time and, you know, put themselves on be on the front lines, really. Benny Green was like, you know, it's your time to be on the front lines. You know, I'm gonna stay home. And, you know, as someone who's 30 years old and Russell Hall is 26 and Kyle Poole is 27, you know, someone has to bring this music because it's you know, it's a healing, it's therapy, it's all of that for the world. And it's important that we bring it and affect people who have, you know, gone through such a tough time in the last year. So, you know, we consider it a sort of a humanitarian effort, and it's also what we do and what we love to do. And so that's the mindset. You know, it's a bit weird to travel and everything's a bit different. You could have a 20-hour travel day in a mask. And things are, you know, there are sacrifices that need to be made now, but overall I think we've been fortunate with it and people have been really appreciative.
100%. I mean, I love the fact that you're continuing to do it, and that's your mindset, that's your philosophy, that's how you see it that way, because it really is a gift to people. Maybe I'm going to walk back a minute. I mean, you've been, you know, at the piano since you were what, 3?
Yeah, I started when I was 3.
Yeah, and how did that come about? And in terms of your evolution to becoming the jazz pianist that you are today. And you just mentioned some of the greats that have obviously influenced you. You know, why were you drawn to this particular kind of music, or, you know, that kind of thing? I'm just curious about all that. The origin story, if you will.
I started playing piano, Suzuki piano, at 3 and a half. And I feel that's a method where you learn by ear. And then you put the, you know, physical notes to the music after you learned it by ear. And I think it really just lends itself to the way we learn jazz, which is such an oral tradition. Listening to records, figuring things out, going out to jam sessions, you know, being around other musicians, seeing how they play and absorbing it, you know, through osmosis. And so that's always how I kind of learned music, rather than looking at sheet music and trying to sight read it. So I'm much more, you know, coming from an ear perspective than a note perspective. And that's, you know, big part of jazz, and improvisational music and music where you play together with other people and create a moment. Or many moments, and so, you know, I think it found me in many ways, for productions in school of musicals and various things like that, and got to know some of the songs. And, you know, there were singers in school and summer camp and various places that needed accompaniment, and so I would, you know, learn some of those standards. Or I remember beginnings, maybe when I was 10 years old or something like that, maybe 11, 12. I was in summer camp and there's someone who wanted to sing Good Morning Heartache and At Last. And I remember not knowing and seeing a lead sheet for the first time and trying to figure out the chords. And, you know, it was just a conglomeration of many different experiences that kind of all fed into this thing. And when I was in middle school, I heard Charlie Parker and John Coltrane, and I was playing saxophone and clarinet at that time, and I was taking lessons, and we worked on some of those solos, and I was, you know, playing piano and hearing Oscar Peterson and trying to understand what that sound was about. And so it was just came from a lot of different directions. Music around the house, I got to see some of the great jazz musicians. My dad would take me to see Monty Alexander, Marcus Roberts, people like that, and put on BGO in the house, and you know, it just came, you know, to me from many different sides.
Right. No, I love that. And I love that you learn by ear. I mean, that was always my forte also. I mean, I played a little bit and I started with fake book, and I got to like Mixolydian scales and things like that. And I was like, I'm walking away. Cause it was just a lot. But I love that your fluidity around this was just sort of organic, and that, you know, you say it found you. And I think that's the best. That's so funny.
You know that, you know, you say like the Mixolydian scales and this and that. There was a moment where I was feeling that, and I'm still feeling that, because I'm much more of like a language and an ear and a, you know, aural player than like this scale and this chord and this stuff, which is important too. But when I mentioned Monty Alexander, when I went to see him when I was 12 or 13 or 14 years old, I went up to him after. I said, "Mr. Alexander, do you use the modes, like the Lydian mode, when you're improvising?" You know, I was a kid, and I asked him, and he's like, "Emmett Mann, I don't know what the Lydian mode is, man. I play the air."
I love that.
And so it's funny that you just said, you know, the Mixolydian mode, and this, that's what I was feeling. And I asked Monty Alexander if he uses the modes and stuff, and he said no. And I think that was kind of a light bulb moment where I was like, okay, they're trying to teach me all this stuff, but really, like, you know, really it's just supposed to come from here. So kind of took the pressure off at a young age, you know?
Right, which is so amazing and so beautiful. And I so love that you had the courage and just sort of curiosity to ask him that question, and that he was as authentic and as embodied as he was in his response, because I feel as though, you know, in my experience, just in life in general, I'm a poet. That's my art, right? And so I don't study, read, format, whatever poetry. When it comes, it's coming, and it flows, and it's right. And I know when it's good and when it's shitty, and, you know, all those things. And, you know, I mean, I like to do other things like decorate and cook and things like that. But this idea of creative, meaning generative, meaning something is emergent out of you, out of whatever amalgamation of events that you're experiencing, I think is a special gift that, as a somatic psychotherapist and life coach, I'm using a lot of people's right brain experiences, their images, their sort of meanings, their interpretations of things, to get them out of just this linear, logical left brain piece, which is useful for a lot of things, and not always the thing that's going to get you to the place of your heart, is that heart-centered place. And so maybe talk a little bit about how that helps inform how you show up. Because when you show up with all of the folks that you bring into your apartment, you do this beautiful Monday night live stream that you can tell people. I know how it kind of started because I heard you talk about it before, but you could mention it if you want, because I really want people to come in and tune into that and donate to your, you know, to your trio. Because as you said, you know, all three of you have been doing it all the time, but that you really have appreciation and respect for all of the greats that have come before you and an awareness around not being appropriative, I believe, in the way in which you go about that, especially in this time of the pandemic, Black Lives Matter, COVID, all these things that we're navigating in terms of social justice. I really feel as though you're aware of your social location as a 30-year-old white Jewish man in the middle of what is a genre that is typically a Black musical genre.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think you just have to remember, you know, you don't have to be European and white to play European classical music, and you don't have to be anything to come to a culture and interact with their art form, and you know, jazz is Black American music, but the beautiful thing about it is that it can let people in, and as long as you are aware, as long as you know, as long as you carry it with you, as long as you continue to educate and you continue to, you know, to create with that in mind, I believe that, you know, that it's all right. And, you know, we're all out here just doing the best we can. and, you know, anything I can do for the music, I think is more important than anything that I can do for myself. Really. So I think, you know, part of our mission is to make as many people aware of this music and aware that it's something that's supposed to be fun and supposed to be from here and not really supposed to be from here as much, like we were just talking about. And, you know, I've come across a lot of people who say, hey, you know, I didn't think I liked jazz. And then I heard you guys and like, turns out I really do. So, you know, it's been part of my mission also to make people who don't think they like this music interact with it and feel something, and you know, also incorporate other aspects of life and culture and different kind of musics. You know, Kyle and Russell, for instance, are very, you know, very well versed in the music of James Brown, Stevie Wonder, and Prince, and you know, even everybody up until today. You know, we listen to PJ Morton and incorporate his styles and feelings into our music, and we kind of just add whatever we hear. You know, Russell went through a phase of listening to sea shanties, and so Russell and I play classical music together, you know, kind of impressionistic music together. And so incorporating all of those other aspects while staying true to the core of what it is, Black music, and trying to come to it with, you know, some funk and some, you know, just natural personality.
Yeah, and you do. It's joyful. I mean, from your crazy jackets and pants, you know, you're always very colorful. And, you know, I mean, it's fun, right? I mean, it's you're performing, so you should have some, I don't know, attention to the fact that people are watching you, as they should.
It's all part of the expression, I think, you know.
Yeah. Do you have a particular like thing about that you're like, you know, today I'm feeling my yellow pants versus my pink pants or whatever it is, or you just whatever's not for me?
I don't know. You know, for me, it's like we did these concerts in my house. So like we'll sound check, and then like 10 minutes before, like I can see what everyone's wearing and then kind of go match it.
Got it. that's cool.
Unlike a gig where, you know, you show up in a suit and tie and you're the only one in a suit and tie and everyone's, you know, wearing casual stuff, and you're like, oh, I didn't know that this gig was casual, which happens. Or, you know, you have a fancy gig and then a not so fancy gig, and you show up to the not so fancy gig in your fancy gig clothes, and everyone's like, where are you coming from?
Right. You gotta let loose, let the tie out.
So you never know. It's an expression, and people dress different ways, and but it's part of the music, you know, for sure.
For sure. It's part of that engagement. You mentioned a little bit about the fact that you and Kyle and Russell spend time in your trio, exploring different genres or different aspects of music, different kinds of music. What is your quote unquote like practice routine? Is it that you always just get together with them and improvise? Do you write music? I know you just have a new album. Tell me about your creative process and how disciplined is it or how loose is it? And I say that in the sense of, obviously it's disciplined in its own way, like we were talking about with the right brain and coming from the heart. But I think you know what I'm getting at is do you wake up every morning and spend an hour doing, you know, stuff on the piano, or do you spend an hour doing yoga?
I mean, I think in different parts of my life, it's been different. You know, it's been a different journey. Growing up, I practiced every day for however long I had, or for however long I had it in my attention span when I was young. Played classical music in high school and felt like I could never practice enough and never had it, you know, completely down. And I think when I got to college, I like really found my practice routine and groove, and I was doing 4 hours every single night, and I was in some competitions to the American Pianist Association and the Thelonious Monk competition, and that really inspired me to practice and really try to get a sound out of the piano for the first time. I grew up playing upright piano, so this was my first experience like having prolonged activity on a grand piano, and how this and how to interact with that. And so I had a routine I was almost doing every night, you know, from 8 to 12 until the music building would close, and then, you know, go do whatever, you know, college people do after that.
Wow.
So that was like, that was probably my most disciplined, you know, four year kind of period of practicing all the time. And because I had the time to do it. And then when I, you know, moved to New York, then I was getting my master's in Manhattan School of Music, but I was going out to every club, you know, all over the city. I had this routine where I lived by Smoke Jazz Club on 109th Street. I lived.
Yep, been there.
On Broadway, and I would go to Smoke Jazz Club, and then I would go down to Dizzy's Club, which is on 59th Street, Columbus Circle, and then I would go down to Smalls after that, and kind of trying to catch everyone that was playing, and maybe say hello, maybe. You know, just check out the music and see what New York was about. And then maybe if it was a Tuesday, go over to the Zinc Bar in the Village or down to the Fat Cat, and then, you know, take the train back up and go to, you know, maybe stop in by Smoke and see what was going on the way home. And so I was going to school in the day and I was doing this at night. I think I did that every day for about 60 or 80 days in a row.
Wow.
I was like, okay, I'm going to just go and meet everyone there is to meet in the city. I'm going to hear everything. I'm going to see everything. I want to show the people at the clubs that I'm serious and that I moved to New York and have the people at the doors know I moved here. And so, you know, that was my discipline when I moved to New York. I wasn't practicing as much. You know, I had practiced, you know, my whole college to get ready for this moment. And now it was time to focus my energies on the vibe of New York and the energy and you know, that slowly turned into, okay, oh yeah, this guy's here now, let's put him on this late night gig that pays $20 at such and such. And so then I would, you know, be on a gig and meet people that way and then be practicing on, you know, on a gig, and you know, playing and practicing are two different but similar,
yep,
balancing acts. And you know, now that well, not now, but after that, you know, I started going on tour and playing these gigs with various people, and the practicing would become, you know, being on the bandstand with Harlan Riley or Ollie Jackson or Brian Lynch or Kurt Elling, or, you know, the jazz masters played Jimmy Cobb and Jimmy Heath, and the Dizzy Gillespie Alumni Band was my first gigs in New York, and, you know, just taking as many opportunities as possible, and then being in those opportunities, and those became the learning experience, the practice, you know, that I would you know, learn from on the bandstand, and that became kind of like what I needed to do next. And so that I had been in that cycle almost for 7 years of living in New York, and then the pandemic hit, obviously practicing when I'm home, and you know, you get into like different vibes where I'm like, okay, I'm going to practice very seriously, like for these 3 weeks that I'm home. And then I go on tour for 2 weeks. And if you play piano and you go on tour, you only touch it when you play gigs.
Sure.
So there's a sensibility that you are forced to develop where you just go sit down at the piano and you have to like build the warm up into the gig, into the sound check, into whatever it is. And just like be able to just do it and execute without like, you know, you don't have your saxophone in the hotel room. This is not feasible for the piano. So especially if you're not the band leader and, you know, I'm there with Kurt Elling and he's doing his thing. And I'm like, okay, I'm just, you know, playing when I'm told to play. Kind of thing. So that's a different kind of practice. And then you're learning on the gigs, and then, you know, Russell Hall and I, we would record all the gigs, especially when we were on tour with Trio, and we would listen back to them the next day in the car or on the plane or whatever, and we would listen to them together and like, oh, that was a nice moment, or no, that wasn't really happening, we should try.
I love that.
This song was too long, like, man, let's try to like do this thing with this. Oh, I have an idea. Let's do it. And then the practicing became like, okay, we listen back to the gigs together and analyze the music and say, okay, how can we make this better tomorrow night or the next 5 nights? Or maybe we've been playing the song too much. We need a new song in this vibe. Or, you know, that original thing we tried, it worked, but not right there in the set. And so there's all, you know, there's infinite amount of ways to analyze and practice. Sure. That became effective. And then for the past year, I spent a lot more time at home and really got into a different kind of practice routine with all of the, you know, classical music that I hadn't had a chance to get to in a long time. And I also spent a lot of time with the Stride pianists in this past year, you know, Willie Lyon Smith especially. To learn some of his repertoire and get through some of that stuff where it takes consistent everyday practicing to achieve that. And, you know, for the past few years, I haven't had the ability to do that. So, you know,
silver lining, so to speak.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Silver lining, a little extra time to practice and work and do all that stuff. And I know you asked me about this before, but not only did I want to practice piano during the pandemic, but I also wanted to work on some other aspects of my life. And
yeah,
you know, so I spent a lot of time reading in this past year, especially just fiction. I wanted to kind of, you know, read creative things that people had conjured up from the depths of their brain. You know, mm-hmm. Maybe come here and conjure up something from the depth of my brain. Mm-hmm. My yoga practice, especially, I hadn't cooked anything, you know, pre-pandemic and forever, maybe ever, you know, besides scrambled eggs or whatever. But
sure.
So I got, you know, that's part of my routine now is to cook and work on my repertoire in this past year. So I was working on that, and I'm very into chess too. So I spent some time working on my chess game.
Online, or do you play with people live?
I mean, I will play with people live, but you know, it's a pandemic and you're not seeing too many people, so
right,
definitely online. And
have you ever played Go?
I don't know what that is.
It's an ancient Chinese game. It's kind of like chess, but there's no winners or losers really. It's interesting. Anyway, just a thought.
I'll check it out. I like logic kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I interrupted you. You wanted to finish your thought about playing chess and the other things that you were doing in terms of your practice and stuff like that when you were home during the pandemic.
Yeah, just various things that I was that I wanted to work on, not only at the piano, but you know, and also the business side of what we were doing to keep Russell Hall and Kyle Poole and myself afloat, and you know, do this, you know, live stream that we do behind me every week. And we've done 48 as of this interview.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, now that you say it, I was going to pop up a screen share and let people just listen to a clip of what you did 2 days ago on Monday. How's that for, you know, just for a minute or two? How's that sound?
Fine.
Is that all right? All right, hold on a second. I want people to get a flavor because we're talking about your music. So hold on a second. All right, so now we're going to just listen to a couple minutes of your Live at Emma's Place, volume 48 from Monday. Okay. I'm just going to pause it there and just kind of come back to you and just sort of as you watch yourself, you know, are you reflecting on like, oh, this is what I was doing there or that? I mean, it's your nuance, the subtlety, the feeling, because you say you come from the heart. This was a little bit more of a more mellow version of something that you play. I can probably find something else that's a little more active, if you will. But what's going through your mind as you watch yourself there play? Anything?
Well,
you're so in the zone.
Yeah, I was remembering the song, and a song called Contemplation, and that was a Wayne Shorter tribute. And so not something I played very often, but there's like this huge buildup in the ballad that happens on the bridge. And you caught it right in that moment where I was trying to like build up the energy, like to like just the climax of this like song in the same place that the song climaxes, like it, that I wanted my solo to get to the thing. And, you know, I was kind of trying to tell that to Kyle, you know, sitting the opposite way. So when we play in the house, I don't have eye contact really with the guys. So I have to talk to them through the music. And so I was reflecting actually in that moment on how I was trying to build up the energy and talk to him through the energy. And that I was going to say, okay, we're going to build it up to here and we're going to release it just like it does on the melody. Okay. And so that's what I was talking to him through the music, and then he built it up, and then we like hit the big downbeat, and then he went switched to the sticks, right? I think maybe he already had them, but I think he like switched cymbals or something. So he changed the color right after that, and then we just kind of brought it into like more of like a little like kind of wind down dancey kind of feel. And that's what I was communicating to him, and then he kind of communicated to me by this mix. And so we're constantly talking to each other through the music.
Yeah, I love that. And you know, one of the things that had occurred to me when you were speaking earlier is, well, two things. One is, you know, from a mindfulness perspective, mindfulness is about being in the present moment, knowing what you're doing, when you're doing it, as you're doing it, being aware, sort of having that accompanying. My teacher, Jack Kornfield, talks about, you know, loving awareness, mindfulness, but from a heart-centered place, from a compassionate heart-centered place, not just the mind, but keep that body-mind, the whole of the gestalt of one's essence and embodiment as a person on the planet, right? And what are we bringing forward in that way? And I loved what you were saying earlier about this, you know, we're doing this here now and we're doing that here now. And you're always meeting whatever the moment is. So you're responding from a place of what we would call equanimity or balance, which comes from the discipline of having put in and clocked in some of those hours and time and things like that, but then opens up to this place of freedom and creativity. And really, I think what is the generosity that comes from being in this place where you started, which is we want to share joy. This is, you know, a joyful practice. This is a joyful, you know, connection. This is an opportunity to enable people to just not only be aware of the history of amazing Black music, but also to, and all kinds of music, but also to experience something directly as opposed to have some thoughts or feelings or perceptions about what it means. And so when you're in that moment and you're embodied and you're just right there in it, I feel like you give people the opportunity to actually just be in their moment. And it happens to be often a joyful moment, but that you can't be thinking about spreadsheets when you're listening and watching you guys play.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I mean, I've said it better myself.
but I think that that's amazing because you're capturing your presence and focus and attention to detail, I think, enables other people or gives people a certain degree of permission to really just sink into absorbing the experience. And everything that the Buddha taught anyway is about your own direct experience and being aware of that and noticing where there are layers and papers over of what you think is something that goes together, but it doesn't really necessarily go together.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, discordant, you know, kind of sounds and things like that, that, you know, we say, well, that's bad because it sounds, you know, off. I remember I was listening to Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, you know, years ago in Boston. And I was like, I don't know what this is because it was really far out.
I was at one of those shows.
Yeah, it was. But I was like, you know, but you can't ignore it, you know. And for me to be able to recognize that my preference was for what you play on Monday nights. But I recognized that there was an experience I was having that was very embodied and very direct around listening to that music that they were offering that I found unpleasant. But it didn't make that music bad or them bad musicians and you and your music good or a good musician. It just made it different. And so this idea of preferences, I think we can bring into just our awareness in terms of getting into the moment and being mindful of the joy that we're experiencing when we're listening and being presenced by you and your friends.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, you have to understand that Herbie and Wayne, what they were doing when they were my age was a lot more accessible. And there was a particular path and a particular journey to let them be able to be on stage and play music that they heard the birds, you know, that they hear in their heads that relate to the birds and the wind and the ocean. And they're, you know, they're really trying to play the sounds of the earth and the universe and the galaxies and you know, all the things that they did leading up to that moment kind of made it. You know, makes it make sense and makes it like authentic. And there is that, you know, these people play the blues. These people play, you know, with Miles. These people, you know, do their own. Wayne Shorter, Art Blakey for, you know, Congo African drums forever and ever and ever. Wrote all the music for that band. And this is kind of natural, reflection of what comes out after so much of their lives are lived. And so there's also something really special in that, and I always try to remember that as well when I'm listening to any of the jazz masters do what they do.
Yeah, no, and I so appreciate your offering and your insight on that. And I guess I'm sort of naming and recognizing that it was different for me to experience that, and I noticed that there was a part of me that found it less pleasant. But I have absolutely no qualms and no doubt that all of what you just say is 100%, because as an artist, you're always, you know, if you're not emergent, what are you? You know what I mean? You can't just be like, okay, I'm going to do this, you know, happy birthday again and again and again, whatever version of that, you know, cookie cutter thing is. And you can always find a new thread to interpret or to allow to flower out, I'm sure. But it's a question of whatever it is that's coming forward is coming forward for a reason, influenced by all those things. And I loved what you said about playing the sounds of the earth and the cosmos and the galaxies and all of that. And that resonates for me. And I know that, you know, they're practitioners also in terms of, you know, sort of spiritual practices that are interconnected with their music. So tell me about your yoga practice. How did that come about? And how does that help support or inform your music playing, if any?
I mean, it really came about. I had some injuries with my hips, and I didn't have time to go to physical therapy or try that. And they said, you know, the only way to fix these torn labrums is to go to, you know, get these surgeries and need them on both sides, and recovery is 9 months apiece. And
oh God,
I said, well, you know, I don't really have, you know, time or energy for that in my life, and it's not guaranteed, you know, full recovery. And so, someone told me to kind of check out this physical therapy stuff, and I noticed and found out and read that it was directly related to yoga. So I started going, started a yoga practice and started going and found a teacher that I really connected with, and yeah. And you know, just practiced multiple times a week, every day. And that was about three and a half years ago that I started that. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't even touch my toes at that point. So I came to it largely from a physical perspective. Like, you know, I wanted to, you know, really master some more of the physical aspects of my body. You know, and it was just started with something, you know, the goals develop. First it was, you know, I just want to be able to touch my toes. Mm-hmm. After months and months, maybe a year, you know, I was finally flexible enough to my hamstrings and my back and my, you know, body. And you know, as I was learning, I learned how the breath integrated into all of this. And it really kind of reminded me of the way that I always thought about my breath when I play music. And when, you know, when you're lost, or when you're unsure, or when you're nervous, when you're feeling anything, you know, you can always return to the breath. It will always be there. And you know, through competitions that may be, you know, super nervous, through playing for the first time with jazz masters like Ron Carter, who you know, maybe a younger age when I hadn't, you know, done as much.
Sure.
Those things would make me so nervous. And you know, coinciding with the yoga practice, like, I always realized that the breath is something that's always constant as long as we're here and as long as we're alive. And that we need to honor it, and we need to be aware of it sometimes, because some of this thing that happens that we're often not aware of. And when we become aware of it, we can tap into another kind of power and another kind of depth that really links our minds and our bodies together. And so it was always something that I considered in music. And then when I learned about it, learned the power of it, and as it relates to body and meditation and quieting your mind and quieting your heartbeat, and how powerful of a tool it is, then I, you know, even got deeper into it. And so I've been practicing yoga for 3.5 years now, and it's been a part of my life a couple, you know, times a week at least. You know, something that you can do in a hotel room, you know, to you know, to stay active, to stay in shape. It's something that you can do in place of a nap to get energy. It's something that, you know, you can turn to, you know, after a long flight, you know, I can turn to that to feel better, or to shake the jet lag, or it's just another tool to help me in my life. And I'm glad that I found it, and it, you know, continues to inspire me in many different ways of thinking. And you always find a different teacher who has a different way of approaching it, who makes you think about things differently, and it makes you think about a lot of things differently, not just about the yoga practice. So it's something that's interconnected in many things we do, just like the breath is, and the mind and the body, and the connection between everything. So I love the connections that it makes in my life.
I love what you're saying, and I love that, you know, it's the breath is with you for as long as we're alive. We can always return to it, and how that can be an anchor. And, you know, in mindfulness practice, it's really just that. It's that, you know, when we get lost, when we get taken away, just like you're saying, when you're, you know, on stage, but even in life, I mean, in a way, life is a stage, right? And so we're sort of navigating that, and to just kind of come home to ourselves and remind ourselves we have a home here.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of things that they say, especially at the end of, or at the beginning or end of practice, you know, even something as simple as, you know, for yourself and something greater than just yourself. And that's something that one of my gurus always says, you know, you do this for yourself and something greater than just yourself. And so it's like fairly open-ended, but it's, you know, it reminds you that, you know, like that you're doing this for you, but you're also doing this so that, you know, you project onto others something that might be able to help them. And that's what the music is about,
isn't it? Right. Well, there's a fluidity there, I think, right? Because you're receiving from the audience, even if it's a virtual audience. I know you have a couple people sometimes on your couch when you're in the room, and clearly you're feeling the vibe of the other musicians that are there. So you're not always alone, although during the pandemic it's different. But maybe speak a little bit to that exchange, because, you know, from a mindfulness perspective, we talk about interdependence, we talk about causality, things as process, nothing is fixed, that we think that we're these little, you know, two-legged, you know, two-handed, you know, mammals that walk around and have language and all these kinds of things. But that kind of cuts into this idea of being separate sometimes in a way that yes, we honor our uniqueness and we're part of this collective and this process and exchange. So we're offering and we're receiving, we're offering and receiving all the time, just like you and I are right here on this chat. And then I want you to talk about your new album.
Which part did you want me to go first?
Well, the offering and the receiving.
Yeah. Well, I think that jazz has existed in very many different kinds of formats always, and the offer and exchange is different in each of those. It's going to be different if you're playing in an art gallery with food and drink, people are just absorbing music. It's different if you're playing in a European classical concert hall. It's different if you're playing speakeasy where people are dancing, partying, going on dates. It's different if you're playing on a live stream and it's over the camera. And I think it just exists in many different places, and the music adapts and it's flexible and improvisatory, and we play. I try to play in a different way, depending on where we are, who the audience is, how well versed they are in what we do, what their attention span seems to be like with the you know, if it's a soulful audience in Detroit, it's going to be different than the audience in Japan. It just is, and you know, to realize that, to adapt quick, and then to play. And with that in mind, not to pander to anything, but to keep that in mind and to know who you're talking to. You know, the way, you know, we interact when we talk to someone new, we assess who we're talking to, and we come up, you know, in our brain with a way of communicating. And that's how, you know, I'll talk to you differently than I'll talk to some of my friends. And that's just how, you know, I play differently to some people, you know, rather than others. And when we play on camera, it's a totally different thing that it's taken us a good chunk of a year to learn how to make that happen, and how to say, okay, can we, you know, this work on camera? Does this work? Oh, does it work when I, you know, look into the camera? Does it work when I avoid the camera? And to get to know that situation is just another, you know, has been another journey for me and for Russell and Kyle and for all the different guests that we have.
Yeah. So let's talk about your album.
Yeah. So it's called Future Stride, and it just came out in January of 2021. And it features Russell Hall and Kyle Poole, the trio. We actually recorded it pre-pandemic, which is pretty funny. We had no idea that this was going to happen when we were recording the album. And it features Melissa Aldana, one of the great tenor saxophone players of our time, and Marquise Hill, another trumpet innovator. And it's the first time I've really taken all the lessons from the Masters and the Masters Legacy series, thing that I've made a series of records with Jazz Masters and made it my mission to learn from them. And been able to take all those lessons that Kyle and myself and Russell and my whole generation has learned from doing these projects, and bring them into our generation, and use those teachings and those the philosophies to create with the young masters of our generation. And so that's been like a really awesome kind of thing to experience.
That's so great. I know you, this whole thing of being with Russell and Kyle in your apartment on Monday nights doing this stuff sort of came out organically from the pandemic. I heard you talk a couple times about how you sort of, you know, went shopping for cables and sort of just had an idea one day to sort of say, how do I get enough equipment that isn't too expensive to just kind of make this work? And then it's really turned into this thing where you've had like, you know, 50 episodes basically. And is that something you're going to continue to do indefinitely, or what's next for you and the trio?
I don't know. I think, like, you know, when we decide what's next too often in our lives, then we're wrong you know, about what's next. And so I really like to just kind of, you know, follow whatever just happened, you know, whatever the vibe seems like it should be. And for me, you know, the pandemic hit and we said, okay, all these tours are canceled. Let's do a little live stream in the apartment. It turned in from an iPhone recording. It turned all the way into, you know, four camera setup with microphones on all the instruments, this video guy, a sound guy, someone working the back end on the internet on the other side for the Facebook and YouTube, and you know, a piano tuner who comes every Monday to work to tech the piano, and then different guests and various people, you know, coming in and out of the episodes. And so I never would have imagined that, you know, if I had planned, I couldn't have planned that. And so I like to just see, you know, what happens, and then come with an idea, and then, you know, kind of just develop the idea in whatever way. And, you know, we'll still consume this, and if they want us to come and play on Monday nights, then that's what we'll do. If people looks like people aren't watching anymore and it's not really happening, then, you know, we'll pivot and find something else. And so I think that's the improvisatory nature of it, and really just try to, you know, just come to it with a sense of goodness and joy and respect, and, you know, try to see what we can do.
Goodness, joy, and respect. Emmett Cohen, people can find you online at...
No, it's emmettcohen.com, emmettcohen.com, or Instagram and Facebook and YouTube. And,
yeah, all that.
All those places now. But the best place is to sign up for a newsletter, and then I, you know, put all my information in there that people should know.
Beautiful. And you write a beautiful blog once a month or whatever it is that you do about that. And I remember reading your post on some of the stuff that had happened last year with the Black Lives Matter movement and just the various, you know, things. And it's really, I think you do spend time reflecting and meeting each moment and coming from, and you keep pointing to your heart, your chest. And I love that, because that opening, I think, is what ultimately perhaps will save us. So. Mm. I just want to say thank you so much. Deep bows to you, Emmett Cohen, for sharing your joyful nature and spirit with the world and whatever beings are, all beings everywhere, as we like to say. And thank you for joining me on the Rerooted podcast today.
Francesca, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take it easy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.